Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll look back 20 years at 9/11. For those who protect government buildings, a lot has changed. It's also an especially tough time for many veterans, how listening to them can help. Also, many parents want more options for their kids to learn remotely this fall. Few schools, though, are providing those. A new Texas law bans abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. The law has energized both sides of the abortion debate here in Illinois.
I know that patients will travel here to Illinois because at the height of the pandemic, when the governor briefly outlawed abortion by claiming it was non-essential services, we had a patient travel 1,000 miles all the way from Texas to Aurora to access abortion.
And we remember Adlai Stevenson III. He died this week. That and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, some parents want more options for full-time remote learning for their children. Also, we'll remember a former U.S. Senator and two-time candidate for Illinois Governor, Adlai Stevenson III. He died this week. And with the Afghanistan pullout and the anniversary of 9/11, it's an emotional time for some, especially veterans. We'll hear more coming up on Statewide. Few will forget where they were September 11th, 2001. For me, I was working at the Illinois State House preparing for a typical day, and then the news came. Reporters in the press room all gathered around a TV in the main area. Soon after, officials sent everyone home over fears government buildings could be the next target.
This is, by the way, the first time, according to what police have told us, the first time in at least 30 years, maybe ever, that the Capitol has been completely evacuated the way it is right now. This is even on some other days in which there's been terrorist activity. Remember the Oklahoma City bombing, for example. All that was done was a heightened security watch at the Capitol. So I think everybody understood that it probably was one of the better moves. People, certainly their minds not on working today in any of the office buildings, and I think probably the best thing is to let people go home with their families, and that's pretty much what the decision was.
It's hard to imagine now, but at that time, access to most government buildings was pretty easy. At the State House, you could walk right into any entrance, no one checked. 9/11 changed all that. The Illinois Secretary of State oversees the Capitol complex in Springfield, and I talk with spokesman Henry Haupt about protocols put in place after that day.
Back in 2001, at the Illinois State Capitol, along with capitals throughout the United States, individuals could walk right into a Capitol building without presenting identification or without encountering an armed guard or without encountering X-ray machines or magnetometers. And of course, 9/11 was a day that will live in infamy and is a day that changed security throughout the United States and how we think about security. But in Illinois, the watershed moment occurred in September of 2004 when an unarmed guard was shot and killed on September 20th, 2004 at the Illinois State Capitol building. Okay. And at that point in time, the guards were not armed and there weren't X-ray machines or anything of that nature. And after that tragic event, the Illinois Secretary of State established the Capitol Police. We always have approximately 50 armed Capitol Police investigators that work for the unit, and their job is to ensure the safety of all of the people who work in the Capitol complex and all of the individuals who come and visit. We also have all of the entry points throughout the complex manned, and we have X-ray machines and magnetometers, and individuals without proper identification trying to visit any of the complex buildings are required to go through the X-ray machines.
You know, we see this not just at the state capitol, but also at many courthouses around the state and around the country and many other government buildings. But back then, I do remember an argument that was being made against so much security was that this is the people's house where government action is taking place and the people should have the ability to come in and watch their government at work. And that was a big push against the idea of showing identification, going through metal detectors and things of that nature. But nowadays, again, I think people have come around to the idea that more security is here to stay.
From what I've experienced and what I've seen, the majority, the vast majority of people, whether they work in these buildings or they're visiting these buildings, appreciate the presence of the Capitol police investigators and of all of the security criteria that's been implemented to protect and ensure the safety of those that work in these buildings and that visit these buildings. I have not heard an argument from anyone calling for less security these days, and I think that that is certainly reflects the world that we live in today, whether that's you're visiting the U.S. Capitol or a state capitol or you're going to an airport. Security is a lot tighter than it was 20-plus years ago.
And I guess it's a sad commentary on where things are in this day and age. But, you know, we were talking before we started this interview about how you mentioned in the olden days, not too long ago, 20 years ago or so, you could actually run through an airport. You could go right in, not have to go through as much security. People really weren't as watchful of things, but things do change.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone who's been to an airport would tell you today that you can't run through an airport. You certainly wouldn't be advised to do so. They encourage you to arrive at airports in plenty of time so that you can go through the security checkpoints that over 20 years ago didn't exist. And while, you know, I suppose we can look back with fondness at how easy it was to run to catch a flight or something of that nature, I do think, at least in my case, and I think a lot of your listeners might agree with this, that there's an element of comfort knowing that airports and Capitol buildings have taken security so seriously. I feel that we're much safer now in terms of whether we're visiting a building or whether we're boarding an airplane, and I think that that is a good thing.
Henry Haupt is a spokesperson for the Illinois Secretary of State's office, and he spoke with us here on Statewide. After 9/11, many Muslim Americans felt they had to deal with a rising discrimination, and those who remember that day at least understand how it all started. But there's a new generation of Muslim Americans who may not. A Chicago Islamic school worked to teach its young students about it. Odette Youssef filed this report back on the 10th anniversary of 9/11.
Assalamu alaikum.
The 10th anniversary of 9/11 wasn't issue number one for students at MCC Full-Time Islamic School in Morton Grove this week. Instead, the first day of school was. That was Tuesday. Habib Khadri is the principal.
It's exciting. I can't believe it. We're back. Hopefully all of you, inshallah, had a good summer and a good Ramadan. Yes?
About 400 kids attend grades K through 8 here. So we're mostly talking about kids between 4 and 13 years old. You do the math. That means in 2001, the oldest kids were maybe 3 years old when the planes crashed into the Twin Towers. There's a line that divides kids old enough to remember 9/11 from kids that aren't. That distinction kind of crept up on Sadia Barkat. She teaches social studies and Islamic history to middle schoolers. Back in 2003, she gave her students a writing assignment about 9/11.
What were you doing? And, you know, include all the aspects of a primary source. And so they did. They did a great job.
It went so well that she kept assigning it every year.
And when I continued the assignment, every year it would go, like, become more and more vague. And to the fifth or fourth, sixth year, the kids were like, well, you know, we don't really remember 9/11, or we're too young to remember 9/11. And that's when I realized, okay, you know, this is becoming something more, this is becoming history now.
Barkat doesn't give that assignment anymore. She realized that now 9/11 is something that has to be taught because it keeps coming up in class in other ways, just not directly.
You know, we talk about the wars that are happening. Our students might say, well, but why are we still fighting in Iraq, or why are we still fighting in Afghanistan? And that opens up Then that opens up the entire context of 9/11. Then we do go into it.
And for the most part, that's how MCC handles 9/11. It comes up in impromptu discussions in social studies class. Since 9/11, this Islamic school has also started explicitly teaching that extremism is wrong in religion classes. But at least one parent thinks the school should do more. That's Khawaja Rizwan Qadir.
My concern were manifold. First, when you don't have facts about a major event like this, I'm afraid that conspiracy theories or hearsay sets in. The other concern was, if that is the case, then these kids are going to grow up in the society feeling alienated, not fully engaged.
Qadir says the whole point of Islamic schools is to give Muslim youth in America a strong sense of identity. They should feel confident so they can face discrimination and won't be tempted by extremist ideology. Qadir thinks Islamic schools in the U.S. are doing a pretty good job, but he worries the kids are not prepared for mainstream society when some don't even know who Osama bin Laden is. So Qadir decided to address this issue himself. This spring, he gave a presentation to MCC students. It covered a modern history of the Islamic world. It was a history, civics, and religion lesson, all rolled into 45 minutes. At the end, he took questions. A 12-year-old student made it clear just how much more work there was to do.
He raised his hand. He said, how is it possible that Osama bin Laden flew those planes into the World Trade Center, got out of those burning planes, got out of the burning building in the midst of all the policemen and everything, went back to Afghanistan, and then was captured and killed 10 years later?
Qadir says he doesn't want to be harsh. He says after 9/11, Muslim Americans were so busy trying to explain themselves to non-Muslims that they didn't realize someday they'd have to explain 9/11 to their own. Odette Youssef, WBEZ.
The anniversary of the 9/11 attacks and the recent evacuations in Afghanistan make this an emotional time for many veterans. Paul Copeland was in the Air Force. He's now coordinator of Veterans Services at SIU Carbondale, and he talked with Kevin Boucher.
So I have to first say clearly I'm a veteran of the Air Force, and I'm not a combat veteran. My career field kept me principally in the United States. I did do some overseas time in Russia. What's clear from 9/11 and the years that have ensued is that there are people around the world who really hate us and want to do us ill. And therefore, what our military does is essential.
What are you hearing from the veterans about this?
So I have heard a couple of people talk about this is bringing things back to their front of their memory that they had been trying to suppress for some time about the cost of defending this nation. Freedom isn't free, to quote a relatively famous saying, and it does bring back to the front current memory those things that the bad pieces that we want to put away, the loss of a friend or the loss of a comrade, is brought up when you see those images of the coffins coming off the plane in Delaware. I told you I'm not a combat veteran, but I did have a classmate who was killed on active duty, not in conflict, but during just doing touch and goes in a KC-135 in Panama, and they hit the runway and pushed the throttle forward and didn't get enough altitude to, for some unknown reason, to clear the mountain, and he was killed. And he's the one who comes to my mind. This is a dangerous business that we're about, and even the practicing of the dangerous business can be very dangerous.
And I can't help but hope people listening right now, some veterans right now, hearing your voice and how you're willing to open up, that might give a veteran right now, give him hope, don't you think?
I hope that's what I can do for veterans. As I say, I can't necessarily share their experiences with them, but I can certainly sit and listen and be able to say, look, I can offer you some other services on campus through the VA. There are a number of ways that we can provide people to talk and people to counsel and people to help to move past the things that cause us to literally have to stop. And I can't think anymore for a moment. I have to process this memory and file it back away. We actually have two rooms in the Veteran Services area that we've configured as what we call quiet spaces, sort of like the dog lounge that the counseling center set up. The idea is I have got to close the door and just be away from everything for a moment. And I can then process this, file it back away, and then be ready to join the world again.
Some say that the pullout, the evacuation of Afghanistan was too hasty. Do you agree or disagree?
So I think there are a lot of people in Washington, D.C. right now that wish they could turn the clock back and start over. The belief, I'm convinced, these are people of good faith who believed that it is likely that the government of Afghanistan will fall to the Taliban after we leave, but it probably takes 6 months to a year for that to happen. I certainly was shocked, like most people, that it took 2 days. So it's really hard for someone who may have served 20 years ago in the very early days of the invasion of Afghanistan, when we were there for a very specific purpose, to push out the Taliban and find Al-Qaeda elements and eliminate them so that no one else could attack. They would not have the power to attack America again after 9/11. That was a completely different mission set and attitude from someone who may have served within the last couple of years when it was mostly training of the Afghan military. But they all came at it from the same perspective, that we're doing this because we're trying to make this place better for the people of Afghanistan so that the entire world will be safer.
As we wrap this up, is there anything, Paul, that I forgot to ask you, or just something you'd like to say either about 9/11 or Afghanistan or the combination, broad picture?
We are divided right now. And now we seem to be moving back into that. If you take a random person off the street, you will never get a middle ground answer to a question. You get extreme left, extreme right, and talking points from the latest broadcast. That's dangerous. And we all need to take this moment on this anniversary and stop and say, I don't have to agree with my neighbor, but I should listen.
We've been visiting with Paul Coltman, the coordinator of Veteran Services here at SIU Carbondale. And thank you for visiting with us. I hope our listeners were able to get something out of our conversation.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Kevin Boucher with that interview here on Statewide. We have more on the way. Stay with us. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A stretch of Interstate 55 south of Bloomington has had its share of emergencies this year, from flooding to fatal traffic accidents. The Mount Hope Funks Grove Fire Protection District responded to those incidents, and while they provide a vital service, they and many other rural responders are struggling to find volunteers and pay EMTs. In an interview with Ryan Denham, the Fire District Chief Eric Folk recalled a series of crashes in July that shut down I-55 for 14 hours.
There was always a curveball. We always, and we dodged them. I mean, we did the best we could. We were thinking on our feet. IDOT was right on scene. ISP was right on scene. Everybody worked together and communicated good. Those scenes are never easy. There's nothing that goes perfect. I mean, it's just not going to happen. We had to think, okay, don't go down this way, but come this way. You can't go this way because it's closed. So the biggest issue that we had was traffic, and where everybody was coming from, I have no idea, but there was a lot of traffic.
A big event like that, like a day like July 28th, it sounds like you'd be stretched pretty thin by big stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, we are, but it's those instances that we take that and learn from it, and we handle ourselves a little better every time something like that happens, because we've dealt with that. We're not perfectionists, but we know what we're doing with the three people that we have. We just get the job done. Would we like to have more people and then to be able to spread those duties out instead of having, you know, one person doing 10 things, and the other one person doing 10 things? Yes, absolutely. Sometimes it's taxing. You come back and when it's time to unwind and you're the ones cleaning everything up, you're the one, it's still going until you go home. And then the following day, you've got paperwork. For me personally, I wouldn't give it up for anything.
What do you want policymakers to be thinking about as they think about the role that smaller departments play in communities like this? And what types of changes may be needed to make sure you've got what you need to get the job done?
So first and foremost, it's funding. We get all our funding from tax dollars from the community, and they only have so much to give. We can't just keep taxing these folks. at some point, we have to figure something out on who's going to pay for these services so that they stay. If two people end up leaving here, it could just totally shut the doors. And that's scary. And then they're looking at 15, 20 minute response times. And I know in the calls that we've ran as an ambulance service when we started in 2003 till now, that sometimes you don't have 15, 20 minutes to respond. So looking at state level, local levels, to see where some of the funding comes from. Recently, I was able to speak with the Lieutenant Governor's office, and we are actively having conversations regarding the shortage of rural EMS and fire, and I hope that I can continue that conversation with them. They seem very in tune with what I had to say, and hopefully they understand what there's a lot of folks out there that have more knowledge than I do about the situation. I'm just a voice.
Anything else you want to add or closing thoughts before we cut you loose?
If you're able to and want to give back to your community and you want to help out, go to your local fire department or ambulance service and see what you can do to help out. And once you're in, you'll realize not only is it it's a fun job, but it's a rewarding job. It's addicting. So to be able to go out there and to make a difference just once is enough for me.
That's the Mount Hope Funks Grove Fire Protection District Chief Eric Falk. He says one of the reasons he connected with Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton is because she was there during those accidents that closed I-55. Well, since the start of school, some Illinois students have been in and out of the classroom because they've had to quarantine. Besides that, some parents are concerned their unvaccinated children could catch the contagious Delta variant. The state required all students to return to in-person learning except for students who are medically fragile. But some parents continue to call on their schools to make a full-time remote learning option more widely available. Lisa Labas with member station WBEZ talked with education reporter Susie Yon.
So Illinois schools are pushing ahead with full in-person learning, although it turns out there is an option for districts to offer a remote program, and that this predates the pandemic. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Right. Even before the pandemic, Illinois law allowed for schools to offer what's called a remote educational program. So a school could choose to adopt a remote policy if it best serves a student's individual learning needs. And that needs to be based on things like a student's attendance, disciplinary record, and academic history. Now, the state says full in-person learning is a requirement this year. And while this school code exists that allows for remote learning, districts have no obligation to create one, and they can limit who can participate. And I should mention, with all the student quarantining that's been happening lately, the State Board of Education recently came out with guidance that says remote learning should be offered when students are in quarantine and if a district is on a pause to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
So you've been hearing from families who say they want their kids to, you know, engage in remote learning. What are they telling you?
Yeah, some families said they've already had to go remote because of a case in their kid's classroom. Some families have said their child is not medically fragile, but they're concerned for a family member at home. I talked to Erica Schaefer. She's a mother in South Suburban Flossmoor. She's pulled her son from public school and put him in a virtual private school.
We will feel much better once our son is vaccinated with the notion of sending him back into a crowded school. However, this whole instance has shown me that the schools, they don't value adaptability, creativity, and flexibility.
And even though no one in her household is medically vulnerable, she just doesn't feel her district has done enough to make school a safe environment.
So how many school districts are offering full-time remote learning, and how is it working out?
Well, so far, the state says 8 districts have submitted a remote learning policy. There could be more, but these are the ones who have submitted. Some of those districts said the option was only for students with a medical need. That's what Chicago is doing. About 450 students are enrolled in a district of 340,000. But some districts are opening remote learning to other students. I talked to one school district, Joliet 86 in the South Suburbs. Now, they are piloting a remote program that's open to medically fragile students, but also students who live with someone who is medically vulnerable. Here's Superintendent Teresa Rouse.
I didn't want our families to not have an option. Why go backwards and not have options for families that we know we can provide? So we looked at the school code and decided, you know what, we can make this work.
So the district is partnering with a tech education company and using its federal COVID relief dollars to fund this pilot program. This seems to be rare because most school districts are focused on in-person learning and not offering a remote option, even though some parents are asking for it. There's even a petition out there that's got nearly 6,000 signatures on it.
Okay, so now that's a pilot program in Joliet. Now, are they considering offering a remote option beyond the pandemic?
Yeah, Superintendent Rouse says if things go well, the district may use some of those federal funds to train up teachers to make the program sustainable. Another option she's thinking about is partnering with other districts to pool resources. She says remote learning should be an option beyond the pandemic because some students have done well in that format and schools shouldn't ignore that.
That's WBEZ Education reporter Susie Ahn. Thanks, Susie.
Thanks, Lisa.
Months after the fire at the ChemTool facility in Rockton in northern Illinois, people in that community and beyond have been left trying to make sense of its effect on the environment, specifically the Rock River. It flows directly adjacent to the site of the weeks-long chemical fire. Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco brings us more details.
Testing began soon after the blaze engulfed the ChemTool grease plant in Rockton this summer. The Illinois Environmental Protection Agency tested the waterway for 5 days between June 15th and the 19th.
When we went out there, we were aware of an incident that the firefighting foam had gotten into the river. So we went straight to that point. We took sample, and of course, we found that PFAS was present.
That's Sanjay Sopet with the Bureau of Water at IEPA. And he's referring to an incident early on in the firefighting operation. Lubrizol, the company that owns ChemTool, hired U.S. Fire Pump, an industrial firefighting company. Its crew sprayed a mixture of PFAS-based firefighting foam and water over the fire, which eventually made its way into the river. PFAS are typically referred to as, quote, forever chemicals. It's shorthand for thousands of chemicals manufactured for their resistance to oil and water.
So it happened. It was a problem. And then, in fact, on 17th, when it was happening, there were booms installed, extraction was going on to the extent it was possible. That is why you will see on 18th, when we went back to take samples, we did not find any issue. And same is true for 19th, that downstream sampling did not show any PFAS.
Sopet says that by all indications, the Rock River is safe, but some experts are still concerned. Sonia Lender is a senior toxics advisor with the Sierra Club.
You know, they did put some filters and some booms and stuff in the river near the facility to try to catch stuff on the surface. But basically, you know, now we're looking at a point where the chemicals have been put into the river downstream from the sewage treatment plant, and there we have to live with it. You know, there's not an easy way to treat that water, get them out of the sediments, and really go back to an uncontaminated site.
Lender says that the same qualities that make PFAS useful in consumer products and other industrial processes also have some unintended consequences when they interact with the environment.
The downside of that intense reactivity is that the chemicals basically never break down in the environment. When they get into our bodies and they're found in almost every American, they're found in very high concentrations in your blood, and they stay there for a long time.
It's possible PFAS were already present in the Rock River before the use of the firefighting foam during the ChemTool fire. But soon after the fire, there was a significant spike detected in the Rockton sewage treatment plant's outflow into the Rock River. Lunder says the Sierra Club collected samples from the Rock River nearly a week after the last state samples were collected.
And the top assay told us that there was roughly twice as much PFAS in the river than we were able to measure, or Illinois was able to measure with traditional techniques.
The Sierra Club used the same Michigan-based laboratory that the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency used. The Sierra Club also sprung for more sophisticated testing, which can detect PFAS precursors that standard analysis can't. Sopet did not provide a comment on the Sierra Club sampling results without further information on their testing protocol. And it's not just the PFAS. For Olivia Dorothy at American Rivers, any pollutants present in the Rock River could adversely affect ecosystems, including wildlife.
you know, any type of contamination that might be spilling into the river, whether it's old or new, you know, that needs to be carefully examined, and actions should be taken to make sure that that gets cleaned up properly.
For Dorothy, this incident is especially frustrating because Lubrizol has not released the list of chemicals and additives present in the facility during the fire earlier this summer. So she worries there's no clear roadmap for additional testing.
Whereas if we know the limited range of possible contaminants that could be in there, we can take a much more cost-effective and quicker monitoring approach of the area.
Lubrizol could disclose that information during legal proceedings later this month. There's also the matter of the company's remediation plan, including the removal of 4 storage tanks holding tens of thousands of gallons of liquid on the former ChemTool site. I'm Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco.
Environmental groups on both sides of the Mississippi River have long pushed for the same goals. They both want clean air, water, and soil, but that advocacy has not crossed state lines until now. Eric Schmid has more on the budding relationship between environmental groups in St. Louis and the Metro East.
More than 100 people fill the roadside park near the McKinley Bridge in Illinois on a recent sweltering Saturday morning. They're here to denounce air pollution in the whole region, but especially in the majority black communities that hug both sides of the Mississippi River.
What do we want?
Clean air!
When do we want it?
Now!
The crowd hears personal stories from those who call these areas home, like Alderman Brandon Bosley, who represents Ward 3 in St. Louis.
Then nothing else matters if we can't breathe. Every single breath
That's
we
right.
take in is
Ain't
killing us.
Right.
So my children have asthma. My sisters have asthma.
Bosley's experience echoes what many East St. Louisans share about their community, despite being in a different state and less than 10 miles apart. Norma Patterson is a pastor at Good Shepherd Faith United Church of Christ in East St. Louis.
Oppression takes many shapes and forms. It doesn't have to be behind prison doors. Oppression is in the air when it's time for you to go to sleep at night and you can't breathe.
Other speakers punctuate the common thread of this rally, that air pollution isn't confined to one part of St. Louis. Hillary Scott Ogarende is with the Macedonia Development Corporation in East St. Louis.
So don't be confused as to thinking that it's just isolated in some areas where there are people of color. No, if we continue on the road we are on today, it will spread throughout.
Virginia Wolf Biley helped plan the rally and is an organizer with the Piasaw Palisades Sierra Club in Alton. She says the rally's location, in between the Metro East and North City and County, was intentional.
They're both huge environmental justice areas that have been left behind for decades. There is a lot to clean up, and we have to do that together.
The event underscores a significant shift for environmentalists in the St. Louis region, who largely didn't collaborate across state lines before now. Sister Dolores Sanchez is an environmental justice organizer with Metropolitan Congregations United in St. Louis.
I don't think I've been personally aware, and I think a lot of us on the St. Louis side haven't been as aware of, you know, what the challenges are on the East St. Louis side.
She says the experiences of her counterparts in Illinois are important for her organization to know because both areas face similar challenges with air, water, and soil contamination. Leah Clyburn is a senior organizer with Missouri Beyond Coal and also helped plan the rally against regional air pollution. She says she started working more closely with other St. Louis-based organizations around issues of pollution and environmental justice about a year and a half ago.
As we started going deeper into the conversation, we got really clear that there's no boundaries when it comes to pollution, that what happens here in Missouri lands on the backs, on the shoulders of folks who live in Illinois.
Clyburn says she's heard nearly identical struggles from people living in polluted rural and urban areas of Missouri, mainly that no one seemed to be listening to them. That same narrative repeated itself when Clyburn contacted groups in the Metro East.
At the end of the day, this is affecting way too many people, and it's not an isolated incident. The only way that we can actually, you know, get in front of it is by coming together as one region and one voice of all races and all representation to say no more.
A key step for organizers right now is to engage communities throughout the bi-state and show they're not alone in their struggle. Wolf-Biley says that will help the St. Louis region speak with a unified voice when pushing for changes in Springfield, Jefferson City, or locally.
You know, we're really stronger together, and it's a lot about building power and getting political will.
She says personal stories are the best tools to compel a lawmaker to support environmental legislation.
So even if that story is about someone in Alton and we're in Jefferson City, they still know that we're breathing the same air and we're using that same water to sustain our lives.
Wolf-Biley says she already feels power and clout building from the fresh ties between environmental groups in the Metro East and St. Louis. In Venice, I'm Eric Schmid.
Coming up on Statewide, we'll remember Adlai Stevenson III. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, the abortion debates right here in Illinois. Well, there's a shortage of school bus drivers pretty much everywhere, and it's caused problems. Peter Medlin tells us more.
Rockford Public School buses won't show up to a dozen routes every school day in September. So at any given point, around 1,400 students will be without a ride. RPS Chief Operations Officer Mike Phillips says they're rotating which routes are cut, and there are some schools that won't be affected at all.
We wanted to impact the schools that had the attendance challenges in the past the least.
But a majority of Rockford students will be touched by the driver shortage. Phillips says if a route is removed for a day, they're trying to make sure it's not impacted again for 9 days. The problem could affect athletics too. Phillips says they're trying to push back those buses until later in the afternoon so they can be covered. RPS needs to hire at least 12 more drivers to ensure they don't have to keep cutting bus routes in October too. I'm Peter Medlin.
The Springfield Public School System is working to ensure its staff has received the COVID vaccine or that testing is available for staff that have not been vaccinated. Governor J.B. Pritzker recently extended his vaccination mandate deadline to September 19th. Springfield Superintendent Jennifer Gill says they've asked teachers to upload their vaccination cards.
We do know that almost 78% of our faculty are fully vaccinated. We know that there are some people that are just saying at this time, I don't want to get vaccinated and are going to opt in to the testing program. And we know there are some that are worried about doing either. So we're working through those details.
Gill says in the past week, 6 teachers have tested positive, as well as 43 students. She says the biggest challenge with positive cases is when others have to be excluded due to exposure. Adlai Stevenson III has died. He was 90. Stevenson was born into a political family with roots in central Illinois. He was a United States Senator from Illinois and twice ran for governor. He was the son of Adlai Stevenson II, who served as Illinois governor, presidential hopeful, and diplomat. Another ancestor was vice president under Grover Cleveland. In 2007, Stevenson read the following essay to mark the October 24th United Nations Day. It's an essay written by his father in 1954 for Edward R. Murrow's segment, This I Believe. We bring it to you again to mark the passing of another member of the Stevenson family who was afflicted, as the family said, with a bad case of hereditary politics.
What do I believe? As an American, I believe in generosity, in liberty, in the rights of man. These are social and political faiths that are part of me, as they are, I suppose, part of all of us. Such beliefs are easy to express, but part of me too is my religion, my relation to all life, and this is not so easy to talk about. Religious experience is highly intimate, and for me at least, ready words are not at hand. I am profoundly aware of the magnitude of the universe, that all is ruled by law, including my finite person. I believe in the infinite wisdom that envelops and embraces me, and from which I take direction, purpose, strength. First to my mind, there springs those words of the 27th Psalm, my favorites. For in the time of trouble, the Lord shall hide me in his pavilion. He shall set me upon a rock. I had fainted unless I had believed to see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen thine heart. Yes, I believe in, and I have experienced his goodness in the land of the living. And I have found no rocks of certainty or safety but his. But having beliefs, or at least enunciating them, is only part of it. Living up to them, for me, is much harder. For as someone said, it is easier to fight for one's beliefs than to live up to them. And I wonder if the chief cause of discord in human affairs is not so much the undesirable nature of beliefs as it is the fighting for them, the competitive indoctrination among them. I believe in liberalism, in individualism, in freedom of conscience. And if there is anything that the whole idea of liberalism contradicts, it is the notion of competitive indoctrination. So I believe that if we really want human brotherhood to spread and increase until it makes life safe and sane, we must also be certain that there is no one true faith or path by which it may spread. Difference is in the nature of life. It is part of our moral universe. Without difference, life would become lifeless. So I reject the idea of conformity, compulsory or complacent, the faith that is swallowed like pills, whole and at once with no questions asked. I believe in helping ourselves and others to see the possibilities in viewpoints other than one's own, in urging the fullest, the most vigorous use of critical self-examination. Thus we can learn to unite in our common search for the truth within a better and a happier world. The basic faith and liberty of conscience is by no means exclusive with us, but I believe we are its ordained guardians in this age of assault and anxiety, when so many seem to believe their doubts and to doubt their beliefs. Finally, I should like to live and not just believe these strong words of faith. In St. Paul's letter to the Galatians, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ has made us free, and not be entangled with the yoke of bondage."
That's the late Adlai Stevenson II's essay. It was written in 1954 for This I Believe, and read by his son, the former U.S. Senator Adlai Stevenson III. The elder Stevenson is buried in Bloomington. The younger Stevenson died this week at the age of 90. After recording that essay, Stevenson III remarked that despite the religious tone of the essay, his father always viewed religion as something very private. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of the state of Texas and let a ban on abortion as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy stand. That invigorated anti-abortion advocates who hope the decision foreshadows one this fall on Roe v. Wade, the case that legalized abortion in all 50 states. Abortion rights activists, meanwhile, are just as fervent in believing the decision, essentially making it impossible to terminate a pregnancy in Texas, was wrong. Maureen McKinney interviewed Peter Breen, vice president at the conservative Thomas More Society, and Jennifer Welch, who is the CEO and president of Planned Parenthood of Illinois. And we hear from each of them about their views on that decision. First, Peter Breen.
The Thomas More Society exists to restore respect in the law for life, family, and religious liberty. The society looks at this as the classical position, the one that has ruled in our country for most of our country's history, certainly is in accord with fundamental religious teachings, but also just understandings of basic biology, that the child in the womb is a child. Texas ban on abortions after a heartbeat is detected is a reasonable legal stand that says we know that you are alive. That's a standard test for life or death. It makes perfect sense that detecting a heartbeat at the beginning of life would be that sign to say, you know, this individual is certainly alive.
Pregnant people in Texas now face a daunting dilemma. They have to overcome the barriers of time and cost to travel to another state, like Illinois, or carry a pregnancy to term against their will, or seek some sort of illegal care. I know that patients will travel here to Illinois because at the height of the pandemic, when the governor briefly outlawed abortion by claiming it was non-essential services, we had a patient travel 1,000 miles all the way from Texas to Aurora to access abortion.
Do you believe the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the Texas law is a signal about whether it will hear a case on Roe versus Wade? And are there particular cases that might go before the Supreme Court that could trigger a national abortion ban?
The decision was about the procedural matter. So
It means that providers, including the three Planned Parenthoods in Texas, are now complying with the ban, and it's nearly impossible for patients in Texas to get an abortion. That ruling was about procedure, not the constitutionality of the Texas law. So the cases about constitutionality still continue. Already this fall, the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear a case about from Mississippi, which was another abortion ban. Both of those cases are examples of the extreme laws that are part of the national agenda to end access to abortion. And I'm very concerned about what the Supreme Court is going to do in these cases. And I'm afraid that they are going to overrule or dismantle Roe v. Wade, ignoring more than almost 50 years of law.
The Supreme Court's decision on the Texas abortion ban is one of a pretty intricate jurisdictional issue. So the real upshot of the Supreme Court's decision is that the state courts in Texas are going to need to hear these cases first, and that is the process by which the Texas law can be challenged. The folks on the abortion industry are still going to get their day in court, but they're going to do it in a different way, not through the federal court system. They will do it through the Texas court system first, and they're going to have all of the protections and all of the defenses that they would have in any other court of law. The idea that the Supreme Court has to jump in anytime a case involves abortion is something that it doesn't apply to any other area of law. We call it the abortion distortion. For those in the pro-life community, that's been this issue that somehow abortion has this special status, that they get to ignore all of the other legal rules.
Planned Parenthood of Illinois supports abortion rights and lobbied for the Illinois Reproductive Health Act and a law also that will trigger abortion rights to remain in Illinois even if Roe versus Wade is overturned. Why were those cases important?
Because I believe, Planned Parenthood of Illinois believes, and in fact, in poll after poll, we've demonstrated that the vast majority of people in our country believe that a patient should make a private decision about their health and their body, that nobody's most personal medical decisions should be controlled by politicians, neighbors, complete strangers like the people who can sue in this Texas law, or anyone else. I think that politics has no place in a pregnant person's body.
The 15-week ban that's up later this year in front of the Supreme Court, that brings forward all of these issues of what can states do to regulate pre-viability abortions. And so it's the great hope of those of us on the pro-life side that the court will recognize that the federal constitution doesn't use the word abortion. In 1973, seven justices on the U.S. Supreme Court invented a right to abortion, even though it had never been the law in our country that somehow abortion was a constitutional right. We are hoping the U.S. Supreme Court will undo that wrong decision from 1973 and onward. And what that just means is that states like Texas, the second largest state in the country, can say, well, after a child has a heartbeat in the womb, we know that child's alive, and we will not allow that child to be terminated by an abortion. And of course, states like Illinois are still free to do what we've done, which is unfortunately to allow for abortion up to the moment of birth on full-term babies.
What does the court's decision mean for abortion rights in Illinois, if anything?
The U.S. Supreme Court is being asked in the Mississippi abortion case to allow the states to regulate abortion again, which was the law for most of our nation's history and was the way things for folks in Illinois, while it is certainly distasteful, our laws allow for abortion on full-term babies up to the moment of birth. So that certainly does not appear to be in accord with the majority view of Illinoisans. We would be able to change that if the Roe v. Wade precedent is overturned, and we could do something like, say, a ban after the first trimester, or something that even folks who are pro-choice would say that they're more comfortable with in terms of abortion policy. Right now, we have a pretty radical abortion allowance in Illinois. It's the sort of thing that states like Texas would look to, and they consider to be barbaric.
Well, fortunately, Illinois passed the Reproductive Health Act, or RHA, and that ensures that abortion will remain legal in our state even if Roe v. Wade is overturned. So we've made Illinois a safe haven for care in our region, and that holds, again, even if Roe v. Wade is dismantled or overruled. But we know that doesn't mean that we're going to be safe forever. The RHA is a law, and it could be overturned or rolled back by future governors or legislators. So our pro-choice champions have to remain vigilant and fight to keep the laws in place.
That's Jennifer Welch, CEO and President of Planned Parenthood of Illinois. And we also heard from Peter Breen, Vice President of the Thomas More Society, both talking about the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision when it comes to abortion in the state of Texas and what other action the court could take on the issue of abortion. That's it for this week Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and don't forget to tune in next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And remember, you can find our episodes at nprillinois.org and our weekly podcast available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.